But we would play a club in Texas, we would play a club in Maine, we'd play a bar in Tucson, and everybody would react basically the same way to the material, and it would all smell and look and sound and feel the same. I mean, it's just that it's the natural milieu for this kind of music. You stand on stage and you stick to the stage because of all the beer that's been spilled by all the other bands. People are dancing. There's a fight over there. Some guy's making out with somebody over there. And, you know, it's great.
Raise a glass for the comrade we've lost. My friend, it's been a long, long time.
Who wrote
it? Steve Angen wrote the song. He wrote it about us growing up at a place called the Upstage Club, which is a little club in Asbury Park, New Jersey, that was open until 5 o'clock in the morning, and everybody showed up to jam and learn different types of music and how to work in front of an audience and pick up chicks.
Hi, this is Southside Johnny from New Jersey in the studio for the best of, if there is such a thing, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes.
In the Out of Control Room with me right now is Southside Johnny Lyon. Welcome back to Dallas, buddy.
Glad to be here.
Nice to see you. What's the first record you even remember buying?
Well, I get asked that question quite often. It's hard to answer because I grew up listening to R&B and blues. My parents loved that kind of stuff. T-Mo Walker and Joe Turner and Billie Holiday.
It was always around the house.
The very earliest remembrances I have are of Billie Holiday's voice wafting up the stairs because we had only one heater in the house. And when my brother and I shared a room and went to sleep at night, we had to leave the door open so that the heat would come up into that room on those cold Jersey winters. And Billie Holiday's voice would come up with the heat, and it was just this very warm feeling. And so I always remember hearing R&B and blues and rock and roll and jazz. And I think the first record I ever bought was a Jimmy Reed album.
Oh, wow.
Way back a long time ago in a cutout bin for 39 cents. And I tried to play harmonica like Jimmy Reed. I never did succeed. I found out later one of his tricks was he soaked his harmonicas in gin, in cheap gin. He'd played four, big glass of gin off to the side, nice warm, cheap gin, and he'd soak four or five harmonicas, and he'd pick one out, and he'd start playing it. And I tried to do that one night at some gig, and I thought, well, I'm going to try that tonight. And I let it soak there for about an hour while we were doing all these other things, playing all the other songs. I reached for it, came in, and inhaled and fell right over it. It was an unbelievable, I mean, wow, how did he do that? I thought I was going to die. Now I know why he sounded that way.
Baby,
So this music wasn't so much something that you had to go out and pursue like so many of the English rock and rollers.
Yeah, no.
This was in the home.
Yeah, I mean, they had great 78s, B.B. King and Ray Charles, 78s, early Atlantic stuff when he was doing really great bluesy things. And that's all we heard. I mean, when they came home from work, my father worked in the post office and my mother worked at the phone company. We were in communications in our family.
I guess.
They would come home, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock, and they'd pop a few beers, and they'd put on Winoni Harris and all these great jump blues shouters, and it would get louder and louder and louder. Literally, the cops would come to our house and knock on the door, and the neighbors were complaining we had to turn it down in this little town in Ocean Grove in New Jersey. So I thought every family did that.
Sure.
And I thought, well, all these people in this little Methodist retirement community, Ocean Grove, all the houses, people would come home and put on, you know, Big Joe Turner.
Right.
Shake, Rattle, and Roll. I mean, obviously that's what they did when they got home. I didn't know about Mantovani and the 101 Strings and Pat Boone. I mean, Pat Boone, who the hell is that? So it was quite a revelation later when I was like 13 or 14 years old and I started hanging out at other people's houses to realize that not everybody listened to music, that kind of music, or with that intensity and that loud.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of them listened to background music. And I just, to this day, don't understand the idea of background music.
No, me neither. It really doesn't. It's kind of a non sequitur, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. I mean, I can understand having songs and tapes on while you're having a party and people are talking and all, but then it becomes part of what you're doing. But to have this little soft music burbling in the background, you know,
I'm told, irritating.
It irritates the hell out of me.
Well, and the converse of that, I'm told from your standpoint as a performer, I've been told by so many of your peers that the worst gig in the world is to perform while people eat.
Yeah, I've only done that a couple of times, and it is a nightmare.
Why?
Well, there's something very disconcerting about singing a love song that really touches your heart and hear the clink of cutlery on a, you know, on a plate. It just doesn't make sense. It's too disjointed.
Yeah.
And people are embarrassed, too. You know, you're sitting there. I went to the long, long time ago in the late 60s, Bruce and Steven and I and somebody else, I forget who it was, might have been Gary Talent. We all went to see Aretha Franklin down at this supper club in South Jersey. This was a big adventure. We got put on a jacket and tie. This is the first time I think Bruce Springsteen's ever worn a jacket and tie, maybe the last. This was back, and we got into Steve Van Zandt's Red Firebird, and we drove all the way down there. It spent $35 a piece to get in to see
Ooh.
Aretha Franklin. Now, this is big, big
That's
dollars.
Big bucks.
I mean, we had to borrow money to do this. And we sat down in these tables, and all the people are all dressed to the nines, you know, and there's a lot of black, you know, middle-class people, a lot of white people and all, and thus four. And we look like, you know, from another planet.
Probably look like the white four tops is what you probably look like.
We looked weird. It's basically what we looked like. But we sat down, and we couldn't wait. Going to see Aretha Franklin, one of our favorite. Oh, this is going to be great. And they put this steak and potatoes in front of us. And it never dawned on us that they were going to feed us while she was performing. And that's exactly what happened.
Whoa.
So, of course, none of us ate. We were completely embarrassed.
Wow.
And it was a weird evening.
That's a strange one. Well, I'll tell you something that's not weird. It is, man, it is so much on the money, and we're going to somehow find out just how all the elements seem to converge this time out for a guy that's been doing it for a long, long time, pun intended. This is Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, the new album, Better Days, and it's been a long time. Listen carefully now. There'll be a quiz at the end of this.
Right.
It's been a long time.
enough to pay the rent.
Oh, what
money got made, baby, and money got spent.
Sleeping when we had nothing left to do.
Under the boardwalk and up on the roof. Ah, we never quite fit, baby, we never played a game. In a time, in a world of our own, making up the rules as we went along.
Just one coat between us, and we never felt cold.
Oh, we were never gonna get old. It's been a long time since we lived together. It's been a long time since we cried. Raise the glass for the comrades.
That is Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, and that is from the new compact disc by the Jukes called Better Days. And I think he's going to be seeing better days. You keep sounding like that, big guy.
Well, that'd be okay, too. Make a little money.
Make a little money, pay the rent, and get some more of those blues records in the collection. Now,
I can't afford them anymore.
Now, it's probably like a New Jersey Summit meeting on this song. And it's a tremendous song from top to bottom, from every standpoint. But then you got the bonus of having you and all your buds on this one track, which set this song up. And then we're going to go through and see if we can identify everybody's song. First of all, who wrote the song?
Steve Anzan wrote the song. He wrote it about us growing up at a place called the Upstage Club, which is a little club in Asbury Park, New Jersey, that was open until 5 o'clock in the morning. And everybody showed up to jam and learn different types of music and how to work in front of an audience and pick up chicks.
Now, Stephen is known by various names, Little Stephen Van Zandt and Miami Steve, all the same guy, right?
He'll always be Miami Steve
there
to me.
There you go. That's right. That's right. That's right. And he's been a longtime mentor, a songwriter, a producer, and player with you for years.
Right. We shoot pool together, that kind of stuff.
Who all, what all vocalists are on this one track here?
That's Bruce Springsteen is singing, and Stephen and I are singing, and let me think if there's a... I think that's it. We do most of the harmonies, too.
Okay.
Now although the rest of the band is doing some of the whoa, 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 because it's a guy thing, you know?
It's a guy
it's
kind
a guy
of thing.
Thing. Yeah, they like kind of doing that
it's
stuff.
It's a thing, yeah.
They're okay. Getting in touch with their maleness when they do that.
Well, let's roll through the breakdown here, which is really dramatic. I love this. Okay, Johnny, you help me out here.
Okay.
We lived in a town.
That's Rob from Milli Vanilli. Sing that one. That's me. Both these lines are me.
Went along, just one coat between
and that's
us,
Stephen.
And we never felt cold.
Oh, we and that's John Lennon.
Yeah.
Does that help you at all?
I think that helps everybody out entirely. I mean, it's you can really, really nail that.
Well, we got a video of this song, and that's going to be on all of the different video stations, hopefully next week or something like that, and you'll be able to see who it is, although I don't know if we remembered who did what. The great thing about the video is they filmed us live, so we didn't have to do a lot of lip syncing. We tried, and I'm the worst at lip syncing. I mean, I fall over myself when I try to remember what I sang on the record. But the video is that song, and everybody sings their lines, and Bruce is in it, and Stephen and I, and the entire band. And
now, was this done at a separate time from a kind of an industry gig that you did recently, or was that all more?
No, that was all done in Asbury Park.
Now, I understand that at this video shoot,
yeah,
that all of these people that are on your record showed up, and,
yeah,
and you all jammed together, and they made that into like a television show?
Well, there's talk of doing that. Basically, what we did, we wanted to just film the band live so that we could get some decent footage for the video and hopefully for other videos that are going to come later. And I never thought of it being a TV show. First of all, I can't imagine anybody putting me on TV, you know? It'd probably be the end of that station, but... That's what they want to do, and it did turn out. The band sounds great, and I even sound good on some things. I probably have to re-sing everything, but then we cheat all the time. You know?
Try to understand before you judge. I'm the kind of man. I still can't live right.
We're talking with Southside Johnny Lyon of the Asbury Jukes. He's brought his new CD in called Better Days. And
you don't call it an album, huh?
Well, it's an album. Yeah, it's an album.
You just can't call it record.
You can't call it record. I still call them record stores, though.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, there'll always be record stores, right? When did you first meet Bruce Springsteen? Do you even recall?
There was that club, the Upstage Club in Asbury Park, where we all... See, back then it was in the mid... it was 67, 68, 69, I think the club was open, something like that. And everybody who had a gig would have a gig that would last till 11 o'clock because we played the Hullabaloos and all these little clubs. And no, we weren't playing bars because we weren't old enough back then. So we needed a place to hang out afterwards, and this club was open until 5 o'clock in the morning. They didn't serve alcohol, so musicians would come in and jam all night long. I mean, there would be maybe 300 people in the club, and 150 of them would be musicians.
Wow.
And I lived a half a mile away, so I was sort of the resident vocalist, and I considered it my turf. And I had been hearing about these other bands called the Castiles, and I forget what Steven's band's name was, but of the Source. You know, these are these bands that were so far away. They were like 20 miles away in the other parts of New Jersey.
And when you don't have a car, 20 miles is a long way.
That's right. And this was our area, you know, all the people I knew. So one day I came in and I walked upstairs. It was on the third floor over a Tom McCann shoe store and had amps built in. So all you had to do was bring your guitar. And there's this guy up there, his long hair, gold Les Paul, doing this great blues song. And it's this whole story song about how he went to Catholic school, and one day a nun brought in for music appreciation a B.B. King record, and it just blew his mind, and the hook of the song was, that's where the nuns taught me how to play the blues, because every time he would get out of control, they'd rap him in the knuckles with the ruler, and so he learned what the blues was all about, and then he heard it, and he learned to play guitar, and it was, and that was Bruce Springsteen, and I was very resentful, because he was great. He had all this charisma. And he was this skinny little guy with this great guitar, and I just thought, what is he doing on my stage?
Right, my stage.
And but we became friends, and the same thing with Steven. He was on the stage downstairs, I think like a week earlier or a week later, and he was playing all these Yardbird things and doing amazing things on the guitar, and I'm going, who are these guys, you know? Why can't they leave me alone?
Some other mule's kicking in your stall.
That's right, boy. I thought I was really cool until all these guys showed up.
I'm trapped.
Well, you know, the great thing about that club is that you could do a lot of different things. Bruce played a lot of rock and roll. He was a big Elvis fan, and he liked even liked the Beach Boys and all that stuff. Steven liked some of the more interesting elements I always thought of rock and roll, like the Yardbirds, and he was really into Clapton and stuff. And I liked blues and R&B. So when we all got together, we traded ideas and we played records for each other, and we all learned a lot. I learned a lot about rock and roll from these guys, and they learned rhythm and blues and stuff like that. And it just was like this college, and there were a million other musicians too. Davy Sanchez would come in and play Thelonious Monk thing.
Oh, he's tremendous, know? Yeah.
And we heard so much different music at this club, and I had an apartment in New York with Steven and a couple of other musicians, and we'd play Monopoly till 5 o'clock in the morning. And Bruce Springsteen is the most cutthroat Monopoly player I've ever seen.
Well, now you've heard it. It'll be in the Midnight Star next week, but it's been exposed right here on Q102.
He's a vicious human being when he gets those dice in his hand. He would bring cookies in and charge you $100 Monopoly money for a cookie.
Get home from my job, I turn on my TV, but I can't keep my mind on the show. When I lay out at night, oh, I can't get no sleep, so I turn on my radio. But the only sound I hear is you whispering in my ear the words that you used to say. Now my day no longer, 'cause my love grows stronger, and the fever gets worse. I've got the fever for you.
Got the fever, oh, oh, I got the fever.
There ain't nothing that a poor boy can do
when he's got the fever for you.
Got the fever, oh, oh, I got the fever.
I can remember coming home, I see you standing at the store with the dishes on the table, till I'm ready to go. Oh, never on out to a movie show, something that you'd like to see. Whenever you're my sun in the morning and my moon at night, think about you, baby, I feel alright. Never go longer as my love grows strong. Fever gets worse and I've got the fever for you.
Got the fever, oh, oh, I got the fever.
There ain't nothing that a poor boy can do
when he's got the fever for you.
Got the fever, oh, oh, I got the fever.
Sure, love this little one.
Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. The first album, right? What year was that?
1976.
76, right? And the song written by Bruce Springsteen, done by the Jukes. That's Johnny on vocals with The Fever. You know, I got to ask you about the great sound that's on the new album, Better Days, because, you know, after the first album there in 76, which we just heard, which had great sound for its time, the second album sounded like it was recorded on a bad AM radio.
Yeah, that was a nightmare situation. We got put in a union studio with union engineers, and it was either do that or don't make a record. And it just was like pulling teeth trying to get any kind of sound at all. And we had all these ideas, like we wanted to use the five satins and the drifters, and you know, we wanted to make it a lot more produced. And unfortunately, we walked into a situation where they wouldn't let us. So, you know, the thing is with record companies, I think that especially for somebody like me and the kind of music that I make and Steven and I, they treat you like the bastard child, you know, the orphan. It's very rare that you're going to get anybody in a record company who's really going to go to bat for you and get everybody to go to bat for you. Uh-oh, here's the record company guy from Impact.
He's standing there with a bat, and he's up at the plate.
It's very rare. Fortunately for us, this new record company, and this is no schmooze bull, they have really gone to bat for us. They said, look, here's your budget, which was more than ample, although Steven didn't think so.
Producers never do.
And they said, go make the record. We don't want to hear anything. We don't want to know anything. We trust you. Make the best record you can possibly make. If you need any help, if you need anything, let us know.
You're right. They never say that.
No, and we called them a number of times for certain things, for certain people. You know, we needed this, we needed that. And then we went to make the video. They gave us everything and more, and they made it a big event, and they've done everything. It's really been great.
It's nice to hear you say that, and it's about time.
Back then, though, on Epic and later in Mercury, they tried. There were a lot of people who really liked us. We were signed by the president of Mercury, but you know that only goes so far. If there's a guy down the line who doesn't really like your music, he can really screw you up, and that's what happened to us.
Okay, let's ask now. Let's talk about that. Did you find when after you got that first record deal, after you recorded The Fever, and after you started taking it out on the road to other parts of the United States, were you surprised at all to find out that regionalism in everything, accents, types of cuisine, and music is alive and well in America?
No, I kind of knew that. You know, I had spent a lot of my teenage years sort of roaming around the country, hitchhiking and hanging out. I had a friend, Dougie, who had he got out of Vietnam with a bunch of money, and he bought a Dodge Challenger
or
Charger.
One of those Chargers.
One of those huge, you know, 400,000 horsepower cars. And we went all around the country, and, you know, he was AWOL for like a year and a half. But then he got malaria, so they had to let him go. Anyway, so I saw a lot of the country, and I talked to a lot of people and ate a lot of the food. What surprised me was, what I was really surprised the most about was that every bar and every club was the same. You know, I mean, I would go to Amsterdam and play, and it'd be the same thing.
No kidding.
Except that pot's legal over there, so a little bit mellower, maybe. But we would play a club in Texas. We would play a club in Maine. We'd play a bar in Tucson, and everybody would react basically the same way to the material, and it would all smell and look and sound and feel the same. I mean, it's just the natural milieu for this kind of music. Is you stand on stage, you stick to the stage because of all the beer that's been spilled by all the other bands. People are dancing. There's a fight over there. Some guy's making out with somebody over there, and you know, it's great.
So, if that is indeed true, then how, why were you pigeonholed as having a certain, like a Northeast sound, and only doing well in, let's say, from the Northeast up through the Great Lakes, and just, you know, and having little pockets here and there? But you mentioned, you know, if somebody doesn't like your music, it can be hard.
Well, I think that it's easier to do it that way. You know, I mean, if you say, oh, well, they're real well known in the Northeast, but we won't play them, they won't play them over there, that means that guy gets off, you know, his job is a lot easier. He can use that as an excuse. Well, I couldn't get them played because they don't get played in you know, East Jibip or wherever.
So you really do refute that there is regionalism in musical styles, that the country is so big
Oh, no, I think there's certainly a lot of regionalism. There's lots of different musical styles that come out. Like San Francisco in the late 60s could only have come out of San Francisco in the late 60s and that
That's
kind of
true.
Stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't think that good music is rejected anywhere if people give it a shot. You know, I mean, there's a lot of records I have in my record collection that no one has ever heard. Had they heard them when they came out,
they'd have been hits.
They would have gone, wow, I really like this. Now, whether they'd been hits or not, I don't know. But at least they would have gotten heard and played and appreciated. And it's the same thing all over. I mean, I'm sure you have lots of records, too, that you can't imagine why this wasn't number one.
Oh, it happens to me once a month.
Well, it's not regionalism so much as it's just a lack of will on somebody's part to really go to the wall for a song.
Hmm.
And you look at this. There's a million stations, and for every station, there are two slots for new records, and there are 50 billion records coming out every week. So
That's
what are you going to do?
Yeah, it is tough. How many albums does it make now for Better Days total?
I think this is 11, but every time I
see... New artist, 11 albums.
Well, I think it's 11. It's either 11 or 12.
This is Coming Back from Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. It leads off Better Days.
While the town around us died, I played on broken stages.
from the new Southside Johnny and the Asbury Juke CD, Better Days. That one's called Coming Back. Who wrote that?
That Stephen wrote that one, too.
Oh, man. What a great, great song. Now, we don't have time to play all, like, 14 songs on the CD, but I understand that you got your licks in writing-wise on this album, too, right?
Yeah, I wrote Souls on Fire and All Night Long with Bobby, and there's another one I can't remember. Oh, well, The Right to Walk Away.
Okay. You were testifying while that song was on about the reason why you do this, and I said, man, you got to tell people. Don't just tell me. You said, and you pick it up from here, you said, I don't care if anybody ever buys this
album. Now, when he goes to the record company guy again, he just fell right over.
He said, you just want people to get a chance to hear it. Why is that?
Well, because I really care about the music. I mean, I love making it. I love playing it. I know that when people get involved in it, like the band and, you know, the audience that we get, they have a great time. And it means as much to me that they like it as much as it means to me to listen to, like, Sam and Dave or Ray Charles and really get off. I mean, a lot of that music pulled me through a lot of bad, bad times. And hopefully people will use this music to get to better days, too. That's one of the meanings of the title. I was telling you that the last album I made was a ballad album, Slow Dance, all ballads. And a lot of people didn't get to hear it because it was tough for radio to play it. They didn't expect it from me. But the people who did, I get people coming up to me on the street all the time and say, we got married to this song.
And
we conceived our child to that song.
Oh.
So that was exactly what the album was made for, you know, for the more romantic moments.
Yeah, but that's real, too. It's not just romantic. That's real life.
Made it for my wife and I. I didn't make it for, I mean, I wanted everybody to hear it. I wanted everybody to enjoy it. But that was an album that I really just focused on. What would I want to hear when I'm alone with my wife?
Oh, that's nice. Well, think about it. The big moments in one's life, when you get married, and when you, like you say, conceive a child or have a child, and these people are coming up to you and saying,
yeah,
your music was an integral part of some of the biggest moments in a person's life. Mm-hmm. That's got to be the payoff.
Yeah, it's great. You forget a lot of times that you do make music that people use for a lot of different things. It's such a struggle making it and keeping going and playing. And even when things are going well, I'm sure if you talk to U2 or something, they'd say, oh, it's really a struggle keeping going. Because it is. It's hard. It's a continual focus on what you're doing and just pounding away. And you forget that people are actually out there in their cars cranking it up, listening to it, or in home or whatever. Or
in
the backseat or wherever.
Yeah, right.
And that's, you know, it reminds you of what you did with the music you loved, and now you're part of that. I'm stunned that I actually make something that other people like, that they really can, that enhances their life, hopefully. I mean, I never thought of doing that.
Oh, I believe I see a train coming, baby.
I see a train coming.
I know it's coming.